I'm chairman of The Spectator, and I'm delighted to see so many of you here tonight. I'm sorry we're running a few minutes late. I actually flew in from Athens this afternoon. I was on a business trip. The traffic was appalling on the way from Heathrow to here. I almost was much later. If I ever see the mayor, I'll have a word with him about that. Just a few housekeeping notes. If you want to tweet, and we encourage you to do so, tonight's hashtag is hashtag SpecBoris, or you can tag at Spectator Events. You can win tickets to the famous Spectator Christmas carol service. It's on December the 10th in the Fleet Street Church, the Journalist Church of St. Bride's, by entering your, leaving us your credit card. No, not your credit. You can leave your credit card if you want, and you'll never see it again. But your business card will do with your email, or just write your email on a scrap of paper. The next event is on Monday, the 10th of November, when our guest will be Neil McGregor. You've probably heard his series on Radio 4, the original one of 100 Objects History of the World. He's now been doing the same on the history of Germany, and he'll be here to lecture on Germany, Memories of a Nation with Neil McGregor. And that is here on November the 10th. So easy to remember, November the 10th here, December the 10th, the carol service. And you can sign up for our e-newsletter, our events newsletter, at Spectator Events website. That's enough from me. You are here to hear the Churchill Factor, an evening with Boris Johnson. Please welcome Boris Johnson. Who said public meetings were dead?
That's right. Well, we've been here before, of course, Andrew.
We have.
I think we had a youth hustings or something.
We did. And we were not the youth.
No, we were not. but we survived.
But we did indeed. We did. Now, the Churchill Factor. Why did you write this book?
Well, I wrote it for the very simple reason that a very kind firm of publishers approached me, and they said that it was the 50th anniversary of Sir Winston Churchill's death next year, and that they were looking for a book, and I got the impression that absolutely everybody else who was better qualified than me, Jeremy Paxton, Andrew Marr, yourself probably, they were all basically doing something else, and so the finger of fate pointed to me. The Churchill Foundation, the Churchill Estate, wanted a book to mark the 50th anniversary of his death, and I leapt at it really because, obviously, like many of us, I've been a lifelong fan of Winston Churchill ever since I could study picture books, because we had a picture book about his life. And I felt that he was starting to recede in people's memory. And this may be wrong, but I felt that I read somewhere that loads of kids thought that he was basically the dog in the insurance advertisement, and that he was a racist and a bigot and all that sort of thing. And I think insofar as he is remembered, it's basically for 1940 and for his sublime leadership in the war. But the whole rest of the constellation of his achievements is starting to recede in space-time, and those gigantic stars are getting fainter and fainter. So stuff like, his role in the foundation of the welfare state, his role in the First World War, foundation of modern Ireland, Israel, making of the Middle East, Europe, you name it, Cold War, blah, blah. I thought that was starting to be a little bit lost in the modern generation. And I thought, yes, wow.
And when you did the book, obviously you knew a lot about Churchill beforehand, but you had to do a lot of work on Churchill too. I've seen the bibliography and the people that you spoke to. At the end of it all,
It almost killed me.
It almost killed you.
I get up incredibly early. Any member electorate of London here should realise that I did entirely in my own time. I worked prodigiously hard. I burnt the candle both ends.
You're not running again for mayor. You don't have to bother with that.
I know, but they're they pay my wages.
Very well. At the end of it all, what did you learn about Churchill or think about Churchill that you hadn't known or thought before?
I think the biggest thing that came through was how absolutely prodigiously hard he worked and his unbelievable volcanic energy. Roy Jenkins, who wrote a brilliant biography of Winston Churchill, had the same feeling at the end too, that this was a man who was basically running on a different type of petrol, and he was capable of, he produced not just more words than Shakespeare or more words than Dickens in his life, he produced more words than Shakespeare and Dickens combined. And he won the Nobel Prize for Literature. He produced thousands of words of memos a day. And he did it all with the most incredible regime, which involved basically drinking about a pint of Paul Roger a day, as we've attempted to do, but not succeeded, because we didn't have time just now. And then he would go on to, he'd have a very good lunch. Then at dinner, he would have red wine, white wine, brandy, and all the rest of it, cigars, and he would go into his study in Chartwell and pace up and down. At 10 o'clock in the evening, he would start to compose. When most of us, you're a journalist, I'm a journalist, and I don't know any modern journalist, tough species though they are, cockroach-like in their hardiness. I don't know any modern journalist who can do it. Anybody can do it after lunch.
Yes.
Write articles.
But not at midnight.
But not at midnight. And he could go on until 2 or 3 in the morning, dictating absolutely perfect, brilliantly excogitated, masticated.
Excogitated.
Bits of excogitated.
What's that?
It means thought out.
Very well. So why didn't you say that?
Because I was using a the sort of flowery Latin word that Churchill might have used before.
But he used lots of Anglo-Saxon words too.
That's right. And that was the genius of his speaking style. Because I think Harold Nicholson points out that it was his great gift to swoop from the very flowery Latinate words to the short Anglo-Saxon zingers that really penetrate people's consciousness, or get through to them, to put it in a less flowery way. And the classic examples of this, there are many, many fantastic examples from his speeches, but we will fight them on the beaches, we'll fight them on the landing grounds, we will fight them in the hills and in the streets. We will never surrender, he said, right? Now, there's only one word in that clump of words that has a Latinate or Romance origin, and which is it? Surrender, obviously. And he knew that if he wanted really to get people listening, that he had to use short, simple words. So he'd say, swooping, he would go, "Never in the field of human conflict has so much been owed by so many to so few." A remark he made in Uxbridge, as it happens, as he was leaving the bunker there. But that's a perfect example of Churchillian rhetoric, because it's very flowery to begin with. The field of human conflict is obviously a very flowery way of just saying war, isn't it? But then think what a wealth of thought is compressed into those short English words. So much, the whole freedom, democracy, everything that we were fighting for in the Second World War, owed by so many, entire public of Britain, America, the free world, everybody who was watching this incredible spectacle of the Battle of Britain. And then so few, the pilots of the RAF. So he's got it absolutely nailed, this whole thing in just a very, very short compass. And it is, of course, as everybody can tell, it's a classic example of a descending tricolon with anaphora, isn't it? So much, never has so much been owed by so many to so few, is a descending tricolon with an aphora, which shows that he instinctively went for the classical rhetorical devices. And another example of this is not the end, it is not even the beginning of the end, but it is perhaps the end of the beginning. Now, what's that? Anybody know what that is an example of? That's an ascending tricolon with an aphora, but varied by chiasmus, right? Because he's got the end and the beginning swapped around, hasn't he? Which is a classic Churchillian, and indeed a classic rhetorical device. He loved that thing. He loved swapping things around.
One of the remarkable things in the book is that when the country most needed him in 1940, it was really quite surprising that he was there. There were so many times when he could have been killed,
yes.
Whether it was trying to be a pilot and crashing, or charging into dervishes and Afghans and Boers. It's amazing
absolutely.
That he ever survived for the Second World War.
Dutch settlers rather than hairy pigs. That's absolutely right. He probably did shoot hairy pigs too. He was unbelievably brave. He was basically, in his physical bravery, he was, most people nowadays would say he was mad as a box of frogs. I mean, what you say is absolutely true. He's the only prime minister in the history of this country to have come under fire on four continents. And this is something that the Churchill family asked me to play down, and I have played it down. I've been very delicate in my language about it, but he personally, with his own pistol, probably dispatched more than a dozen people across those areas, with which we now want to have friendly relations, obviously. and he was almost suicidally brave in his aviation. I mean, if you think about it, the airplane was invented in 1903 by Orville and Wilbur Wright at Kitty Hawk. Barely 10 years later, Churchill is at the Admiralty, and he is personally taking off. He's flying these unbelievable contraptions made of leather and wood and canvas and rope and so on, and they are death traps. I mean, I think one flight in 500 ends in disaster. And, you know, for ease of comparison, ladies and gentlemen, you may like to know that only one in 14 million journeys in London by bicycle ends in any kind of accident. He was taking phenomenal risks with his life, and actually, several of his instructors were either seriously injured or killed just after.
Well, you give that with the most amazing name, Gilbert Wildman Lushington.
I know, a tragic thing, and Gilbert Wildman Lushington is they very nearly have a crash. And Churchill's trying to discover what he's doing wrong, and he writes this letter to
Wildman Lushington,
saying, you know, I think I know what I was doing wrong. I was pushing against myself with the aileron. Basically, it was total. Nobody understood how the thing worked. But, you know, they were still trying to experiment with how to steer these craft, and. Wildman Lushington never got the letter, of course, because he was killed the following day in a side-slipping accident of exactly the kind that Churchill sustained. He had a very, very bad prang at Croydon, and all his family said, "You've got to stop this," but he just went on. And I think there was an element of trying to prove something to himself, and you know, he says that. He'd been a bit of a coward, particularly at school, and he'd always wanted to have a reputation for physical bravery. So I think there was an element of him willing himself to become that big, brave person. Because actually, he wasn't really that way by nature, if you sort of mean. He had fantastic natural spirit, but physically, he was a bit of a shrimp. I mean, he was his 31-inch chest, probably not more than 5'6½, 5'7" in height. He wasn't the huge bison-like character that you see on in the statue in Parliament Square.
But it's your contention that if he had been killed in action in these earlier wars, or gone down while in his plane while he was getting these pilot lessons, that the history of these islands, the history of the world, would have been different.
It would have been, Andrew, it would have been utterly different. And many of you will have, I'm sure, have read John Lukács' brilliant book, 5 Days in May, which tells the story of how they had a series of 29 meetings in the War Cabinet met in the run-up to that pivotal meeting on the 28th of May 1940. And there was so much pressure to do a deal and to make an accommodation.
With the Germans.
With Hitler. And the invitation was there. It was perfectly obvious what Britain could do. And Halifax was for it. Chamberlain was for it. The people, the powerful men in the Conservative Party upon whom Churchill depended for his position, that they were for it. Loads of people in the British establishment, the city, as ever, the city was in favour of doing whatever Europe wanted, basically. There's been no doubt. They were for it. There was huge pressure. And Attlee Greenwood were there, Archibald Sinclair was there, and they were offering sort of tepid support to Churchill, but they couldn't be decisive. They weren't the party that had the seats. They weren't the people who put Churchill in power. Mm. And he had to face down Halifax and this pressure to do a deal when, you know, everybody could remember the First World War. We'd lost more than 1 million people, huge numbers lost in Flanders, and not a household in the land untouched by the grief of that. And here we were only 22 years later, and he was going to ask the British people to go through the whole thing again, put the country through that mincer. And of course, you know, after they took the decision, and there's a, you know, you remember how it happens in that fateful cabinet meeting. He can't really get his way with the seven in the war cabinet, because he's, you know, Halifax keeps pushing back against him, and he in Churchill, even though he's prime minister, he can't prevail. So he has this stroke of theatrical genius, and he decides to go to a meeting of the full cabinet, all 25 ministers from all the departments, and he makes this unbelievable Shakespearean speech in which he says, you know, if this long island story of ours should end, let it only end when each of us lies choking in his own blood on the ground, or something like that. And at that point, they stand up and they cheer, and they clap him on the back. And from then on, he's got them. And he's got the government in the palm of his hand. And he's able to get the policy of resistance through. But of course, within a year of that date, 30,000 British men, women, and children had been killed, almost all of them, of course, by the Nazis. And it is just impossible to imagine any politician today having the guts to take that decision. And so that's why I wrote the book. I wanted to dig in to the psychology of a man who was really capable of resisting and being quite so successful in getting his way against the odds and really making history himself.
So we didn't do a deal with the Nazis, and
it would have been a disaster. I mean, let's be
what
absolute.
What would the deal have been?
The deal was, if you remember, it was a bit of Malta. It was Malta, Gibraltar, a bit of North Africa to the Italians, in exchange for, you know, we'll leave you alone. Mm-hmm. And I think that was roughly the shape of it. And it was obviously shameful in one sense, but it would have meant, you know. The French were, of course, in favour of us doing such a deal because it would have palliated, it would have mitigated their own feeling of shame at the disaster that had engulfed them in 1940. So they were right behind it. But let's face it, in the end, Hitler was going to, he would have assembled an operation to take us out. You know, we would have been more or less defenceless. London, with the best will in the world, hadn't been invaded, as people will know, for a thousand years or so. And, you know, the defences of this city are not strong. I mean, we've got some Roman walls, but they're not in very good nick. It would not have been. Things would not have gone well for us had Hitler welched on the deal, as he ratted on every other deal he did,
including the one with Russia,
particularly the one with Russia. We would simply not have been able to hold out.
And yet,
and then Europe would have become a ghastly, Nazified version of the EU, as it were, or, you know, a sort of a gigantic. Well, it would have been a gigantic. No, I mean, let's be. You know, I measure my words. I think that the EU by comparison is a wholly benign and idealistic project, and it's let's be entirely serious. I mean, the Nazi ideas were in some ways analogous, and they wanted to create, you know, the Zollverein and all the rest of it. And there were things that they wanted to do that were superficially analogous to the. Though actually, their trade policies were pretty hostile to the subject nations. They wouldn't really have had a proper single market, but it would have been an absolute catastrophe for European civilization, a racist tyranny in ruling Europe, and who's to know what would have happened to democracy?
Because
in the world
he could have taken out Russia if he hadn't had the Western side to worry about.
Absolutely right. If he hadn't had to worry about Britain, there is every reason to suppose that Operation Barbarossa could have been mounted earlier and could have succeeded. And then what? And the Americans, you know, why should the Americans have come in to pull our chestnuts out of the fire? They lost about 100,000 people in the First World War. They showed absolutely no interest in coming in to the Second World War. It would have been an unbelievable catastrophe. And Churchill's achievement, of course, was not just in holding out in 1940, but in hanging on and hanging on and getting the Americans to come in. Mm. That's his really stunning diplomatic achievement.
But there was a time, for at least a year afterwards, when people questioned whether it had been right not to do a deal, because he faced a series of disasters.
He
faced Singapore, the Dieppe raid failed, we lost the Prince of Wales, we lost other battles.
Absolutely.
In fact, until Alamein, there were no successes at all. And you say that there was a time when his own position came under threat.
Absolutely, and it seems incredible now. But you know, there was talk of removing him in favor of Stafford Cripps. Can you believe it? And you know, he had some very, very dark times in the run up to Pearl Harbor and the great change in the fortunes of the Allies. Well, the arrival of the Americans, and I think obviously, you know, you can argue that the Americans would have come in because Hitler had made the demented decision to declare war on them after Pearl Harbor. But the only reason Hitler declared war on the Americans was because they were being so useful to the British and helping to keep us going in the North Atlantic and looking after the convoys. And that would not have happened, I believe, had it not been for Churchill's efforts and for his constant wooing of America.
Now, you've had a couple of pops at the European Union.
Well, I haven't really. I think we can classify them as pops. Glancing blows. Accidental. I hope it's big enough to recover from that. It can take it. There's 500 million, of us in the European Union. We can take an odd.
That's interesting.
We're members. We pay for it.
So, but what I wanted to ask was, you have a chapter here on Churchill in Europe. And two things are striking. Let me do them in turn. Let me take the first one, which is on the evidence you present, he's more pro-Europe than anti-Europe.
Oui. In this sense, you know, Churchill, I wish if he'd won the election in 45, he would have been the recipient rather than Labour of the Schuman plan. So they would have sent it to him. He would have had to decide how to respond, what Britain should do, what our role should be in the creation of this European congeries, whatever the word I want is, this agglomeration of European powers. And I think, and if you look at what he says, he would have much preferred an intergovernmental structure rather than the supranational approach with the single judicial authority that's caused so much trouble, and I think, you know, you can't exclude the possibility that he might have got his way. So what I'm trying to argue there is that had Churchill been there at the beginning, with all, I mean, you've got to remember that at that point, in 1948, Britain was by far the biggest coal producer in Europe, by far the biggest steel producer. We were the great industrial power. It may seem incredible now, but we were. Actually, it's not incredible. We're coming back that way. But anyway, that's what. And he personally, Churchill, had colossal prestige in Europe. Absolutely colossal prestige. And you know, wherever he went, huge crowds used to turn out to hear him speak in his fantastic version of French. One thing you can be absolutely certain of is that had he conducted the negotiations, he would have done so in his brilliant Churchillian franglais. You remember when he was talking to General de Gaulle at one point and things are getting tough, he says, "Et marque mes mots, mon ami, si vous me double crosserez, je vous liquiderai." which is, I think, very much the kind of approach that David Cameron should take in the negotiations on the budget, and you know, obviously we'll have to see how that goes.
I'm not sure his French is quite as good as that.
I'm sure it is better.
At first all the states of Europe are not willing or able to join the Union, we must nevertheless proceed to assemble and combine those who will and those who can. He was chairman and founder of the United Europe movement, and he wrote that the prime condition for the recovery of Europe is Britain and France standing together with all their strengths, with all their wounds, and then these two nations offering their hands to Germany.
With Britain.
France, Britain. Germany, and Britain.
Absolutely. And completely right, Andrew. But then, of course, he's a bit biblical because he does...
America wanted it, he added.
Absolutely, of course, absolutely. And it has, of course, as everybody knows, been a long-standing objective of American policy to tidy up this European thing so they can get just one person on the telephone when they want to talk to Europe. And you can understand their point of view. But Churchill also says at various points, and he says in the crucial debates, you know, yes, we must be, involved but not comprised, associated but not absorbed, and all that kind of thing. And if he asked to choose between Europe and the deep blue sea, he tells General de Gaulle, Britain would always choose the deep blue sea. If they had to make a choice.
That's exactly right.
Churchill's policy was for Britain to be at the center of a series of concentric circles. And he was completely right, in my view. It's a vision of the diplomacy of this country that is absolutely right. We should maintain our relations with our friends in the Commonwealth, in the former empire. We should be at the center of all that activity. In fact, we should big it up because it's a booming opportunity for us today. He thought that we should have a leading role in Europe, though. If Europe was a union between France and Germany, then in his imagination, Britain was one of the ushers or the best man or whatever. We weren't actually pledging our troth or ourselves. And of course, the third component of his vision was that Britain should always stay close to the United States, which is his final advice to the cabinet in 1955. Always stay close to the United States. He said, and then he said, man is spirit. That was what he told them.
Man is spirit.
Man is spirit, yeah.
What did that mean?
I don't know, but it's a very good point. I think he was trying to think of something suitably profound with which to leave his cabinet colleagues after 64 years in Parliament and achievements that I don't think anybody else can equal. And by the way, one of the points of the book, it's not just his achievements in the war, about which we've spoken quite a lot this evening. It's his achievements in the run-up to 1940 that I thought were being forgotten. I mean, he is unbelievable in his activity in the First World War and the foundation of welfare and all the rest of it.
I want to take some questions from the audience. We've got microphones all over. If you put your hand up just as we get that in place. Before we do, in the chapter on Europe, and you devote a whole chapter to Churchill and Europe after the Second World War, you don't even mention what many people regard as his greatest European achievement, which is the European Convention on Human Rights.
Well, absolutely true. And one of the, he's one of the founders of that, as he's one of the founders of the Council of Europe and the whole exercise of...
He appoints Maxwell Fife to draw it up?
He does.
But you don't mention it at all?
I don't. Unfortunately, in a book of only 104,000 words, there wasn't space to mention absolutely everything. It isn't a deliberate exclusion.
No.
If you ask,
you're not just keeping your Eurosceptic friends happy?
No. On the contrary, I think that what people will take from the Europe chapter is that Churchill was benignly and vaguely passionately pro-European, but he would have balked, and he did balk, B-A-U-L-K.
Yep.
At the idea of Britain being absorbed into a federal structure.
And he didn't do much about it when he got into government.
Absolutely. That was the test. He could have done. And in the end, what he cared about so much and dedicated his life to, he says, I'm a child of the House of Commons, he told the Americans in 1942, if you remember, I'm a child. And he cared, that was what he felt. He felt that the primacy of the House of Commons would be obscured, that British sovereignty would be lost. So all the arguments that we have today are completely adumbrated, but prefigured in that debate in the late 40s. And you see, it's fascinating to read it, because you see the Tory Europhiles, men like Boothby, making exactly the same sort of arguments that you hear today. Oh, you know, if we're left out, it'll be a disaster. Yeah. You know, Chamberlain and Eden's much more sceptical and
he accuses
so
Attlee of Palmerstonian jingoism.
He does. Churchill does.
Yes,
he does. And he's in incredible form in this debate. You should read the Hansard, because he's well struck in years.
1950.
And he is 75, whatever he is, and he's continually barracking and interjecting
shouting.
And so shouting absolute rubbish.
For Attlee.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right, let me see some hands. Let me get a microphone. There's one there. Keep your hand up where we get a microphone.
Ajit's going to want us to open up the church.
Quite hard if you've got one up there. Let me see. There's a gentleman down here. We got a microphone there. And then I'll get some more. Yes, sir, you first.
On a comparative basis...
You're all right.
Yeah, in your opinion, what are the two greatest similarities, in your view, between Churchill and Margaret Thatcher, and inversely, the two greatest differences between Churchill and Lady Thatcher?
I think that... I'll do the differences first. I think that Churchill... They were both extraordinary leaders. There's absolutely no question. In many ways, Margaret Thatcher's achievement was... In some ways, Margaret Thatcher's achievement was more extraordinary than Winston Churchill's, in that she had further to travel, if you see what I mean, to achieve what she did. She was a woman. She wasn't born in ducal circumstances as Churchill was. Her father wasn't a former Chancellor of the Exchequer and so on. She did unbelievable things. The other great difference, I think, is really that Churchill was not that kind of Tory. He was a Whig. He was a progressive Whig. And yes, he was a reactionary and a romantic, and he loved the empire, but he believed in progress, and he believed that it was the duty of the rich man to look after the poor, and he believed in improving the condition of the people. And he was the founder, not just of unemployment insurance and
the labor exchanges.
And the living wage, but of the tea break. Which was not a popular thing, I seem to remember, under Margaret Thatcher in the 1970s, and he had a different approach to that type of thing. The similarities, most important, really, is an iron determination to get their way. absolute, implacable determination to do what they thought was the right thing, even if loads of other people were telling them not to. So when Margaret Thatcher had 352 economists telling her she was wrong, she went on. And when Churchill had, you know,
Halifax and so,
on and so forth, and you can cite many other examples, and you have many other examples when people told Churchill he was wrong, and indeed he was wrong, but he still went on with it. Okay. And I'll tell you, we'll have some more questions, sorry.
Yeah, gentlemen there.
Just referring to the welfare state, which you mentioned, in the People's Budget of 1909, Churchill and Lloyd George campaigned for a land tax.
They did.
They wanted, Lloyd George wanted, according to your book, a 20% capital gains tax on the increase in a house price. And I just wonder...
He was wrong there.
In the book, you said, of course he believed in...
Keep the microphone up, sir.
Of course he believed in a land tax. And I just wonder what your attitude to that is in view of all these oligarchs buying up houses seemingly with impunity and not paying any tax at all.
Yeah.
And
okay, I can tell by your voice that we welcome you from a former colony, is that right?
We have been independent.
And we, as far as we're concerned, you can buy whatever you like. Churchill was very, you know, he had a very radical streak in that.
And
he was
in the Liberal Party.
Very
right.
He was, yes, he rats on the Tories in 1984. He joins the Liberals and he becomes best buddies with Lloyd George, the two Romeos. They crisscross the country, as you rightly say, campaigning for these the People's Budget and huge changes. Don't forget, although Churchill was the child of Blenheim, when he went to Germany, he was very, very impressed by the difference in property habits between the Britain and Germany. And he couldn't help noticing that in Britain, the toffs still lived in colossal estates surrounded by walls and, ordinary people had tiny little cottages and so on. And whereas in Germany, he felt that there was much less of a gap between the rich and the poor, and he definitely had a very strong radical streak. Whether he would want to impose a mansion tax today, which would be deeply discriminatory on the people of London, for the people, I doubt very much.
All right,
it would be completely the wrong thing.
You describe him as an adventurer, reckless, disloyal, untrustworthy, with death-defying self-belief. Who would you say in British politics fits that bill today?
It is very hard to think of anybody who really comes close to Churchill in all sorts of ways. And one of the irritating features of the coverage of this book is how people have tried wrongly, in my view, sometimes to try to drag the author into the conversation when actually what surprised me about writing about Churchill, he is a one-off. He's totally unique. I mean, I've made some vague comparisons with Margaret Thatcher. They're very superficial. He was totally unlike any modern politician, and that's partly because of he struggled to vindicate himself, to prove himself to his to the ghost of his father, his desire to overcome his own feeling of cowardice and all the rest of it. But also, I think it's because Churchill was a gigantic Victorian promontory sticking out into the middle and beyond in the 20th century. And loads of his contemporaries were actually killed in the First World War, and he survives. He goes on.
Even though he had been in the trenches
Watch. Talking about Churchill's bravery, I mean, he went out into no man's land 36 times on his own, sometimes so close he could hear the Germans talking. And, he was completely bummed in those. I think that made him a much bigger character than we have today.
Let's get some more. There's a lady over there. I can see a hand of the gentleman in the blue shirt. up there, and we'll get another mic. Someone, and there's a gentleman there. Keep your hand up, sir, and we'll get a mic to you too. Yes, to the lady first.
What do you think Churchill would make today of the decimation of our armed forces, specifically the Navy, which has got barely a boat left on the water?
Well, very good question. And Churchill scholars will remember that when he was at the Admiralty, when he was Chancellor in the 20s, he was accused of making cuts to naval budgets and making cuts to armed services budgets generally that weakened Britain's long preparation. That was one of the counts his enemies made against, or one of the accusations his enemies made against him in the war itself. So he didn't have an absolutely perfect record on that himself in peacetime. But he was a soldier, and he loved the armed services. He loved the armed forces, and he believed in them absolutely passionately. And more important than that, he believed the thing that drove Churchill all his life was a belief in the greatness of this country and of the empire. And at the end of his life, obviously, when he sees the flag going down around the world, he does feel a great sense of tragedy and regret. And he says, I've worked so hard and achieved so much, in the end, to achieve nothing. And I think, of course, he was sort of slightly fishing for compliments there, because he achieved a huge amount. But he did feel that, and he would have. I think in one way, if he looked at Britain today, yes, obviously, we no longer are capable of sending a gunboat into every sea or ocean in the world and demanding instant compliance, as perhaps we could when Churchill entered Parliament in 1900, when Queen Victoria was on the throne. But we're still fifth or sixth biggest economy in the world. The condition of the people that he cared about so much has immeasurably improved. I think he would have been stunned by the progress of modern Britain. And Churchill, don't forget, was a massive technophile. He would have loved all these gizmos and stuff.
He would have had an iPad.
He would have had an iPad. He would have been self-Googling the whole time to see what was going on.
All right, Churchill. Let's go up to the microphone there. Yes, sir.
To what extent was the Bengali famine the biggest blot on Churchill's copybook?
Interesting question. If you just give a little background for some of the audience.
Well, in the middle of the war, there was a terrible famine in Bengal, Britain should have done and could have done more to help. And there's no question that Churchill's attitudes were deeply reprehensible. And the things he says about Gandhi, you know, he should be tied, bound hand and foot, and trampled by an elephant at the gates of Delhi, the spot of starvation wouldn't do Mahatma Gandhi any harm. And, the terrible, terrible things I think on India, he really lost the plot, and there's no question now that it's hard to make a defence for some of the things he said. But nonetheless, I shall. He was a Whig, he was a progressive, and he genuinely thought that the empire was instrumental in getting rid of barbarous practices like sati and bride price and the shunning of the untouchables and so on. And he genuinely, and I'm afraid totally mistakenly, thought that it would be impossible for India to be granted self-rule, that it would be disastrous, it would lead to huge intercommunal violence. And of course, though it did lead to some intercommunal violence, and considerable intercommunal violence when it finally happened, no one can now deny that he was basically wrong. And, I think it's probably the answer.
But he wasn't just wrong about...
If the Bengal famine and India are probably the single biggest black marks on the Churchillian...
But he was wrong, too, about the gold standard. He took us back on that.
Yes.
Now, and he was wrong about trying to put British troops into the Russian Revolution.
Wait. Let's just take the gold standard first. Yes, he got it wrong in the end, Andrew, but he was exactly like, we talked about Mrs. Thatcher, he was exactly like Margaret Thatcher in 1989, when she was ganged up upon, as you'll remember, by Lawson and Howe and all her officials who said she had to join the ERM. Remember that? And it was an identical argument to try to fix the value of the pound in defiance of the markets. And she and Churchill had exactly the same concerns that an overvalued currency would be bad for British industry, bad for jobs. That was Churchill's concern, and he has a big argument with Montague Norman in particular, the governor of the Bank of England, and Peregrine Westmore's father-in-law, of course. And he, in the end, loses that argument, even though he gets Keynes in one evening at the Treasury to go over it all. And he decides to go along with what his officials are telling him to do. So I would defend him there. His instincts were right. They were Thatcherian in that respect, and he was, in the end, made the mistake of listening to his officials. And on Russia, on his decision in the 20s to try to stop Soviet communism from being permanently installed, who can say that was the wrong thing to try to do? It was a very good idea to try and thwart Lenin.
Let's have another question.
Benjamin Bilski of the Pericles Foundation. You said that Churchill's a one-off, that there's no comparable leaders in modern times, but you're also greatly inspired by ancient Athens and by Pericles in particular. Is your interest in Pericles and in Churchill, does it come from the same place?
How interesting. I hadn't thought of any comparisons between Churchill and Pericles before, actually, but there are, because if you remember, Pericles was in a very similar position in the outbreak of the Peloponnesian War. I don't know why we're talking about this now, but we might as well. He is the most belligerent of the lot. Mm. He really wants to take it to the Spartans, which and a lot of people are saying it will be a disaster, and indeed it is a disaster. But so ultimately a disaster. Pericles and Churchill.
Think about
something
that.
Something in it. Something in
think
it.
Think about that. We'll have some more questions. There's a microphone in the front row here. There's a lady in the middle there. Keep your hand up and we'll get a microphone. Keep your hand up, microphone there. And let me see and get one. And there's a gentleman way up at the back there in a light shirt, if you keep your hand up too. So, over to the gentleman
Andrew
there.
Chambers.
First.
Hi, Mr. Johnson. How are
Andrew,
you?
How are you?
I'm very pleased that you've written this book. A lot of people ask me about you, and I say that you are one of the people who knows how to use history to formulate strategy for the future. And that works for me for London. I have a question for you, which is that we are looking, and we're now about to open one of Churchill's war rooms
in
Mayfair, the old London Underground Company. And one of the things that inspires me about you and Churchill is that you never give up.
Nor do you.
So my question really is...
Yeah, let's have a question. This
he's a hero of mine. Come
this
on.
This love-in's getting boring. Ask a question.
My question really is, can I have a sentence for the entrepreneurs in London who are making an effort?
Yes. Never, never, never surrender. How about that?
Good. All right. Perfect. Let's have another question. Where's the lady with the microphone? Have you got the microphone? Yeah, there you go. Just hold it up and we'll hear you.
Okay, that's good. Sorry, I'm a Churchill researcher myself at Cambridge, and I was just wondering if you'd actually come across the relationship, or the very, very close relationship between Winston Churchill and Lord Northcliffe.
Well, I'm...
Daily Mail?
He was in with all those guys, and one of the interesting things is how wrong the Daily Mail was in the run-up to the war, and they say some very nasty things about Churchill at various stages, and I think the Daily Mail says that Hitler is a George Washington for our times, and if he didn't exist, Europe would have to invent him at one stage. So they totally
he was closer to Beaverbrook, was he not?
He was closer to Beaverbrook, but at Beaverbrook too. Was not entirely steady on parade and was always sort of actually, you know, going around the back and machinating against Churchill. And you know, he said of Churchill that Churchill lacks the vital note of sincerity for which the country listens. And Beaverbrook was often slagging off Churchill behind his back. So okay. not necessarily
yes,
man
sir.
To go tiger shooting with.
Yes, sir.
You talked about Churchill's energy and his ability to do so many things, writing late into the night and so on. One of the characteristics of many great leaders, whether it's Stalin or Hitler and certainly Churchill, is that they have had a very low sex drive. Would you like to comment?
Well, I'd say, let's hang on a minute. Is it really the case that I think of this as being slightly overdone about Churchill. Churchill's, you know, obviously I took an interest in this point, and I look, you know, he has plenty of girlfriends in the before he gets married to well, not plenty, he has some. There's Muriel, what's her name? There's Mabel. There's a showgirl called Mabel Love. He definitely falls in love with Pamela Plowden. Violet Asquith falls in love with him and doesn't, and it's a bit tricky because her father's the Prime Minister, and he has to rebuff her. There's a rather nasty moment in order to marry Clementine. He had five children, or one tragically died. There's every reason to think that he was, you know, a normal sort of chap in that respect. And, you know, just because he didn't behave like, you know, Chairman Mao or various other sex-crazed tyrants of history.
Or Lloyd George.
Or Lloyd George, exactly. Doesn't make him a lesser man, in my view. And fundamentally, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what he did. It doesn't, because what he had was greatness of soul, and he had it when it mattered.
But as far as we know, we don't believe he ever had an affair out of marriage. Is that right?
Well, there was a very tricky moment in the Versailles conference in 1919 or 19, around about then, when he's out in Paris on his own. And he gets invited by a woman famed for her chic and heartless beauty called Daisy Fellows to come and see my little child, she says. Come and see my little child. And so he turns up and finds no sign of any child, but Daisy Fellows on a chaise longue with no clothes on. And his story is that he fled. And I'm inclined to believe him.
All right, let me have some more questions. Yes, there's a lady with two hands there. So I guess one microphone will do, but you have to keep them up or we won't know who you are. Keep your hand up. Yep. Let's get a microphone there. And let me get another one. Any other hands? And there's a gentleman down there. If you can keep your hand up too, sir, we'll get a mic to you. Yes.
Hi, good evening. What would the Churchillian response to the Ebola crisis in West Africa have been? And would you have approved?
I mean, doesn't this get to an absurd level that Churchill now has to be dragged
Churchill
into
was
everything.
He was anti-disease. He would have been against it. He was broadly pro-hygiene. And
unless you were Bengali.
he was
all right.
He was for, you know, he would have supported any mission to help, just as our government is doing today. And I think actually our government is doing a wonderful job of trying to help.
I would take a couple more questions. But something I wanted to get on to again, we dealt with his attitude to Europe after the Second World War. And of course, you also devote a chapter to the Cold War.
Yes.
And I think one of the really interesting things that comes out of this chapter is you talk about the speech in Fulton, Missouri. He went by train with President Truman, who had taken over from FDR, and he had shown Truman the speech beforehand and the Secretary of State. The interesting thing was that on both sides of the Atlantic, the reaction was hostile to the speech.
Absolutely right. And Truman, the wimp, say, even though he'd shown him the draft, and
this was the Iron Curtain.
The
speech.
Iron Curtain. So he says, you know, from Trieste in the Adriatic to Stettin in the Baltic, an Iron Curtain is coming across down across our continent, you know. And it's an absolutely prophetic and brilliant speech. I mean, it contains fantastically brilliant forecasts. I mean, the only thing that slightly goes wrong, he says that there should be an international air force. Mm. The only equivalent I've ever seen was in Thunderbirds, where they had such thing. But otherwise, it's right on the money, and he exactly forecasts the Cold War. And indeed, he forecasts the outcome of the Cold War.
He says
it will collapse. And he says it won't work. And he totally got it right. And he points out, and he understands why the communist oppression, why the totalitarian system won't work and will eventually be rejected. And he spells it out. And he's very, very blunt in his language about Soviet Russia. And Truman's horrified. And in London, they're horrified, and they all say, "What a disaster this is!"
And
Jim Callaghan, the former Prime Minister of this country, actually was one of the signatories of a House of Commons motion denouncing Winston Churchill's Fulton, Missouri speech. And did you ever hear Jim Callaghan grovel and apologise? I certainly didn't.
Oh well, that's he's
not around.
Okay, let's go.
He's not around.
I just wanted to. Ask you, you've probably come across many anecdotes that Churchill had during his lifetime. One I heard, which is very unknown, is that he was at a Guildhall dinner in 1950, having just been re-elected to Prime Minister, and John Foster Dulles was there with him, who was the Secretary of State from the US.
Yes.
And he had a complete disregard. They didn't like each other. No. And they were standing around after supper or dinner, and Foster Dulles came up and tapped Winston on the stomach and just said, "Winston, what's it going to be, a boy or a girl?" And Churchill very, very slowly, with his friends around him, looked at him and said, "If it's a boy, I should call it George after the King. If it's a girl, I should call it Elizabeth after the Queen. As, however, I suspect that it's only wind, I'm going to call it John Foster Dulles."
You can add that to the paperback.
Yeah,
edition.
I know. Well, that sounds brilliant. I will have to get. We'll get the learned researchers of the Cambridge of the archives onto it. I
mean,
question. What would Churchill have made of Russell Brand?
Oh, well,
this is absurd.
Very good question.
I mean, what would he have made of global warming?
I think he would have been very sympathetic to whatever Russell Brand.
Let's have a couple of questions. There's a lady here shaking her hand, so let's get it to her.
Though it's interesting. I'm proud to say that we're ahead of Russell Brand on Amazon. That's the most important thing. Just about.
That's a good plug.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
it's true.
The rather colourful
well, we were last
over
time
there. Right. Well, yes. Question.
Do you think Churchill should have bombed Auschwitz when he found out what was going on there?
Interesting.
I'm not certain that he is as that it was as clear cut as that.
When did he know?
And I you know, it is alleged that he could have done something to stop the Holocaust, and to the best of my information, actually he was in a position to make the difference that people now say he could have, had he known what was going on, had he been able to stop people being ferried to Auschwitz and that, and indeed to destroy that camp, I'm sure he would have done. But my information is that is not so, and that's one of the false accusations that's made against him, like the accusation that he knew that Coventry was going to be bombed and allowed it to happen. The people say some, you know, on the Bengal famine. Yes, he's banged to rights, but there are some charges are laid against him now that I don't think hold water at all.
All right, who's going to be? Yes.
In your fascinating book, I wondered if you actually fantasized about meeting Winston Churchill himself. And
no, I feel I he used to wear purple romper suits,
as this one, Boris.
No, sure.
So the question is, if you had been actually able to meet him, what would you most like to have said to him?
Oh, golly. At which stage? No, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I suppose I would have asked him, so I would have been totally tongue-tied, and finally, falteringly, I would have stammered out something like, you know, what would you do about Ebola? It wouldn't have been much good. I think that's
so basically that's you made a fool of yourself.
Yes, totally. But the great strength of church. I mean, I'm just looking at your beautiful attire this evening, and I mean, that was, you know, he genuinely did turn up in you know, mauve romper suits of his own designing, you know, looking like nothing on earth, but that was what we were fighting for. And it was people's ability to be themselves.
Okay, a few more questions. We're coming down for time. The gentleman there, I just wanted to be fair to anybody at the back. There's someone right at the back there in a shirt. Keep your hand up and we'll get a mic up to you. Let's go to you first, sir.
Can I just ask you, the relevance of your book to my kids' generation, do you think they should read it and get some, what would they get out of it?
Of course they should read
obviously
it.
Obviously that.
And not only should they read it, they should give it to all their
friends. They're getting it anyway, but what would you think?
I think they will get several things. I think they will get an insight into what I sincerely believe is the greatest leader we've produced in this country for 200 years more, I mean, if not in the history of our politics. They'll understand all the things that he did in addition to saving our bacon and the world in the Second World War, and there is a huge amount that people need to remember about him that I think they're currently forgetting. But they'll also, I think, get an insight into what made him tick, and you know what the hammer, what the chain, in what furnace was his brain? Mm. How did it go? You know what the hell? How did Churchill come to be Churchill? That was what I wanted to explain, and it's an extraordinary story, and I think that there's a reason why American businessmen read about Churchill for and there's a study in leadership, because he was genuinely utterly amazing in that respect, and he wanted to get his way, and thank God he did. I think they'll find a lot to about him.
You said that his final words to the cabinet were stay close to America.
Yes.
And his great achievement in the Second World War was to woo the Americans, eventually get the Americans into the war. He put a lot of effort into wooing Roosevelt in particular. But in the end, he wouldn't go to FDR's funeral.
I know. And so interesting, his views on America, really, and what was going on in his head. I mean, he's half American. Jenny, his mother's American. He makes this fantastic speech to Congress in 42 about, you know, if it had been the other way around, if Randolph had been American, he might have been there on his own. In many ways, he loves America. There's a long period in his life when he is viscerally hostile to America's taking of Britain's place in the sun. And, you know, go back to what I was saying about his feelings at the end of his life, his feelings of disappointment. He felt bitterly that America had done some very hard, a very tough deal in the war. And he, you know, publicly he called Lend-Lease the most unsordid act in history. Privately he said we were being skinned and flayed to the bone. And, you know, it is absolutely true. Does anybody remember when the last time this country paid Lend-Lease money to America?
Just a couple of years ago, or something.
Absolutely right. 2008, Ed Balls wrote a check
to finally pay off the loan.
To pay off the loan, they struck a very, very hard bargain, and there were all sorts of provisions in it that closed off British trade with Latin America, that deprived us of bases in the Caribbean, of colonies in the Caribbean, and so on. And it was, you know, Churchill felt that, and yes, of course, superficially. The relationship with Roosevelt was incredibly important, and he did brilliantly in wooing Roosevelt and, you know, disporting himself in the White House for a long time. And he grossly overstayed his welcome in the White House, and it was like a sort of bouncy castle personality all over the place, and, you know, appearing in the nude before Roosevelt, and you know, generally being you know, quite a house guest. But you know, in the end, there was no question that the Second World War, as A.J.P. Taylor said, was the war of the British succession, and America won that war. And first and last, Churchill was a British Empire man, and he felt that very keenly. So that may have been at the back of his mind when he took that, I think, extraordinary decision not to go to Roosevelt's funeral.
Let me go to the back. Yes.
Hello. Boris, I wonder, can I invite you to revisit, reconsider your rather un-Churchillian response to the question from the lady down here who asked about the rundown of the Navy, and you replied rather glibly that it was all to do with gunboats. It's nothing to do with gunboats. It's to do with the fact that we're a maritime nation, and 90% of our imports and exports go by sea. To protect that trade, we need a Navy. I think that Churchill would have thought that we'd need a decent Navy to do that, and I think he would have been appalled at the level of the Navy we've got at the moment.
All right.
Well, I'm sure that's...
So you've got the Navy lobby here tonight.
I'm sure that's right. The only point I was seeking to make is that actually, you know, people did attack Churchill himself for naval cuts and for cuts in defence expenditure. And so, you know, yes, he would not have wanted to see the British Navy run down.
I was. We're coming to the end. We've overrun, actually, and I know that you've got to get away. But I was into the things, the characteristics of Churchill that you dwelt on in the book. You said he was an amusing talker. That he was a sparkling writer. That he was a very well paid journalist.
He was.
That
he was the best paid journalist of his age.
Indeed. He was half American.
A position now held by...
you. I don't get paid for writing. He was half American.
Quibbling.
He was a big beast, but a kind of isolated figure as well. And he was a politician who got away with things that other politicians didn't get away with.
Yes, well, as I say, I think I've got more in common with a one-eyed pterodactyl or a three-toed sloth than Winston Churchill, and if that was the comparison you were inviting me to do, maybe you weren't.
I just said but what you dwelt on, and I just wondered whether it was a kind of Plutarchian parallel life.
No, not at all, not at all. And genuinely, like most people who read a lot about Winston Churchill, I felt at the end of writing the book, you know, as I went along, rather, it was like, you know, climbing some Himalayan mountain and endlessly thinking that you've got to the summit, and then you discover some whole new vista or some new peak of achievement. I mean, he was an oil painter. He did 536 canvases, many of them extremely good, and one of which has just sold for more than £1 million. I mean, you know, he won the Nobel Prize for Literature and so on, and in addition to saving the world.
Despite Evelyn Waugh's remarks.
Yes, I think Evelyn Waugh was jealous of Churchill's facility as a war reporter. Don't forget that Waugh had tried to do the same thing in Abyssinia.
And wrote Scoop.
And wrote Scoop, but Scoop was a brilliant book. I mean, but it was his dispatches were not as good as Churchill's.
In his concluding chapter in his biography of Churchill, Roy Jenkins concludes that he was the greatest prime minister to occupy Downing Street.
Definitely.
And I assume you would agree with that.
I certainly would. And I think that he repays endless study because he shows what the human spirit can achieve. And I think what he had was greatness of soul. He had greatness of heart. Megalopsychia, as the Greeks would put it, I think. I think I might have made that up, but anyway, that's definitely what it was. I'll give you one example of his of his greatness of heart. When it was in the middle of the war, and the some cleaning lady was leaving the Ministry of Defence, and she spots this thing in the gutter by the bus stop. It looks like a file that could be important. She picks it up, she takes it home, she gives it to her son, who's got something to do with the armed forces. He has a quick look at it, and he immediately recognises it must be incredibly important. And he says to her, "You've got to go back and hand this in." She goes back to the MOD. It's very late at night. There's nobody there really to receive her, and the people there treat her with some condescension, and she has to wait for ages, and she insists on seeing a ranking officer of some kind. And finally, somebody comes to attend to this lady, and she hands over the file, and of course it's the battle orders for Anzio, for the invasion of Italy. And the following morning, there's the war cabinet meets, and Churchill's told about this appalling breach of security, and he turns to Ismay, and he says, "Pug, how did this happen?" And the story is explained to him about the cleaning lady, at which point, of course, Churchill starts to cry, because he was a great, very tearful man generally. And he says, "She shall be a Dame Commander of the British Empire. Make it so." And so the word goes back to the palace, as this has got to happen. And the palace totally sort of funk it. And she's only given an MBE in the New Year's honours. But when Churchill has his resignation honours list in 1945, there she is, Mrs. Mott, DBE. And that goes to show...
Fifth on the list.
It goes to show his greatness of heart, but also, obviously, that he wouldn't take no for an answer, which was a very, very important thing.
That's a great anecdote to end things on, and I know it's in the final chapter of this book as well. We've managed to get 15 minutes more out of Boris than we were meant to. I thank you all for coming along
tonight.
Have a safe journey home. Remember to leave your emails on the way out, and all sorts of wonderful things will happen to you related to The Spectator. It is very good to have a former editor of The Spectator with us tonight, Boris Johnson.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.